There'd be some studies done, there'd be some money thrown at research and finding out just what the causes are and hopefully coming up with some cures. Unfortunately, we're just 1% of the public workforce and we're less than 0.17%, I believe it is, of the entire Oregon workforce. So we don't really add up to a lot of interest for the medical community. So we have to extrapolate from information that's available from other sources.
Mr. Whelan, I guess, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'd like to maybe inquire at this point. You made earlier reference in your testimony to, I guess, we're not talking about pre-existing conditions, obviously. What kind of examination, physical, are people that wish to become firefighters, do they have a fairly rigorous physical examination?
Well, I can only speak for myself, and it wasn't a rigorous examination. I am going to suggest that the result of a conclusive presumption will be the administration of a rigorous stress EKG before one is accepted as a candidate for firefighter and rule out any underlying symptoms or any underlying arterial disease.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I'd just like to point out before I get into the film that the firefighter is the only class of worker in the 1.3 million Oregon employees that has no control over the workplace. We set up attack lines and move from sub-freezing to 400-degree temperatures in a matter of seconds without benefit of warm-up, without carrying very heavy equipment. And if any of you picked up a bucket of water, you know that water is not exactly a light item either. We'll be awake in the middle of the night, ear-splitting bells going off, bright light, and we're trying to piece together fragmented information and figure out what kind of probabilities and possibilities it is we're going to run into out there. The stresses, the mental stresses, dealing with victims of heart attacks, accidents, infant deaths, and their families obviously takes its toll. That bell goes off more and more as we find firefighters' jobs. Going into the emergency medical field. So I included a report from a Dr. Nathaniel Raich on firefighting and heart disease there. It's necessarily technical. You'll find all the esoteric phrases known only to the medical community, but there is a glossary at the end that I hope you'll take the time to read that and fight your way through it. I think it'll be informative. The slideshow I'd like to show will last about 12 minutes, and it was put together by a UCLA research cardiologist, and he studied Los Angeles County or city, I'm not sure, firefighters, and I think this gives you a clear idea of the kind of stresses in the firefighter workplace that are peculiar to the firefighter workplace, and also give you some idea of the response the human body takes to those type of conditions and all. So wait a moment, I'll get it rolling.
Okay.
Which includes many different heart problems. The major heart problem afflicting firefighters, and the one I am primarily concerned with, is ischemic heart disease, which simply means that the supply of blood and oxygen to the heart muscle is not adequate to meet the demands. Ischemia is usually caused by coronary artery disease, resulting from cholesterol and other fatty substances accumulating in the coronary arteries. On the left is a normal coronary artery. On the right is an artery which is 75% occluded. This type of occlusion may cause severe ischemia during exercise or work, and the oxygen demands of the heart increase. If the ischemia becomes too severe, a myocardial infarction or heart attack occurs. This means that part of the heart tissue has been injured, as shown in this slide. Ischemic heart disease can be more accurately assessed with an exercise stress electrocardiogram than with the normal resting electrocardiogram. Many people with ischemic heart disease have normal electrocardiograms at rest. This slide shows normal and abnormal electrocardiographic tracings. A rather consistent indicator of ischemia is a prolonged period of time needed for the tracing to rise after it has reached its lowest point. The electrocardiogram from this firefighter is normal at rest. However, when his heart rate is increased to 145 beats per minute, ischemic changes are seen in the electrocardiogram, which become more pronounced during recovery. This man did not have chest pains or angina and thought he was in good health. Further medical examination revealed that he had severe coronary artery disease and was a high-risk subject for sudden death. This slide illustrates a normal electrocardiographic stress test for the firefighter exercising at near maximum heart rate. These men were subjects in a study conducted at UCLA in a randomly selected group of Los Angeles City firefighters 40 years of age and over. 10% had ischemic electrocardiographic responses to near maximal exercise. The 10% ischemic responses observed in the firefighters was higher than the 8% ischemic responses observed in the group of highly coronary prone insurance executives previously studied at UCLA. These values are both higher than the 5-6% ischemic responses reported for other groups, including police officers and airline pilots. This slide shows that in general, the firefighters in our study had low risk factors for coronary artery disease. The three major risk factors are elevated cholesterol, elevated blood pressure or hypertension, and smoking. Only one firefighter had all three risk factors elevated. 5 had 2 factors elevated, and 47 had none of the three risk factors elevated. Of the 9 men who had ischemic responses, only 4 had elevated risk factors. Firefighter LB had elevated triglycerides, another one of the fats found in the blood in addition to cholesterol. MB had high blood pressure and was obese, as indicated by his skin fold fat measurements. E was a firefighter who had severe coronary artery disease. Since firefighters are a medically selected population with low risk factors for coronary artery disease, the observed 10% incidence of ischemic responses is indeed surprising and suggests that ischemic heart disease in firefighters is job-associated. In order to understand some of the stress which is imposed on firefighters' hearts, initial studies were conducted in the laboratory at UCLA. Firefighters were asked to do sudden strenuous exercise on the treadmill without the benefit of prior warm-up. This slide shows that of the 44 men studied, 43% had ischemic responses, and 25% had other abnormal electrocardiographic changes. When warm-up, consisting of 2 minutes of easy jogging in place, preceded the sudden exercise, the electrocardiogram was normal in most cases. Unfortunately, firefighters don't always have time to warm up. Further studies were conducted to record heart rate and electrocardiographic changes from the men while on the job. This slide shows the recorder which the men were using during their normal 24-hour workday. While responding to the alarm, heart rate showed an average increase of 47 beats per minute, 15 to 30 seconds after the alarm. The increases ranged from 12 to 117 beats per minute. These results indicate an emotional response while reacting to the alarm. The most dramatic responses were observed at night while the men were sleeping. Even while on the truck, heart rate still remained elevated. These data also illustrate that heart rate response is the same in more experienced as well as less experienced firefighters. Some abnormal electrocardiographic responses were observed 15 to 30 seconds after the alarm sounded. These abnormal responses were similar to those observed in the sudden exercise experiments conducted in the laboratory and may indicate ischemic insult to the heart. Here we see the heart rate data obtained from one firefighter responding to 7 alarms during one day. What effect these repeated exposures to emotional stress had on this man's heart and coronary vessels over 15 years of service remains to be determined. These heart rate data were obtained from 2 men while approaching structure fires. Before getting off of a truck, their heart rates were 150 beats per minute, again indicating an emotional response. This slide shows the heart rate responses from the firefighter working 2 consecutive structure fires. 20 seconds after the alarm sounded, his heart rate had increased from 100 to 148 beats per minute. While on the truck, it increased further to 152 beats per minute. During the initial stages of the first fire, his heart rate reached 190 beats per minute. While returning to the station from the first fire, they received an audio call to respond to the second fire. Immediately, his heart rate increased to 152 beats per minute. During the initial stages of the second fire, he was working on the roof when flames came up on all 4 sides. His heart rate reached 195 beats per minute and averaged 188 beats per minute for 15 minutes. When tested in the laboratory, he could not get his heart rate to exceed 190 beats per minute. These data also indicate emotional stress. These data from another firefighter do not show the emotional response to the alarm, but do show high heart rates during actual firefighting. Many factors could be responsible for these extremely high heart rates observed for prolonged periods during actual firefighting. These include the physical work involved in firefighting, the heat stress, the nature of the protective gear, emotional stress, and breathing noxious fumes such as carbon monoxide. This slide shows both the weight and nature of the equipment and the extreme heat to which firefighters are exposed. In order to obtain additional information, another study was conducted in the laboratory to test the effect of the protective gear and the heat on heart rate while working on the treadmill for 15 minutes. Tests were conducted at 72 degrees Fahrenheit in regular blue uniform and then with the turnout and waiver. The third test was conducted in the sauna at 180 degrees Fahrenheit with the turnout and waiver. Note that the heart rate continues to rise as one continues to work in the turnout gear at high temperatures. This is largely due to the continuous rise in body temperature. However, these factors alone are not responsible for the very high heart rates observed for prolonged periods during firefighting. The emotional stress must be important. In conclusion, our studies show that firefighters do indeed have a heart disease problem. A random sample of Los Angeles firefighters had 10% ischemic responses during a stress electrocardiographic test, indicating the possibility of coronary artery disease. This is higher than the 8% ischemic responses observed in a group of Los Angeles insurance executives. These findings are very surprising when we consider that the firefighters were a medically selected population, were in good physical condition due to a fitness program, and had low risk factors for coronary artery disease. These facts suggest that stress associated with the job of firefighting may be causing damage to the heart and coronary arteries. Electrocardiographic recordings obtained from firefighters while on duty show that their hearts are subject to abnormal stress. Working in turnout gear in hot environments also places stress on the heart. All of these factors, plus the noxious fumes to which firefighters are exposed, may contribute to the high incidence of ischemic stress tests observed in firefighters.
Mr. Whalen, if you have some additional comments or if there are others who wish to join at the council or witness table who have come in since you had a chance to begin your testimony.
I won't renege on my promise to not allow Ray Barnwell to get up here and launch into a tirade. I've got Ron Usher from the Local 43, the president of the Portland Firefighter Association.
Excuse me, Representative Johnson.
Tom, was that film commissioned by your organization?
I tell the truth, I don't know. If the credits do not indicate that.
How did you acquire it?
I acquired that through some Washington County firefighters.
I'm sorry?
I acquired that from some Washington County firefighters. I don't know if it was commissioned.
Why don't you find out and let the committee know whether that was commissioned by the firefighter organization?
Certainly. Well, I'd like to underscore some of what was made clear in the slide presentation, and that the statistics by themselves are alarming enough, but I think you have to truly appreciate what a select group firefighters are. It's not uncommon to find 500-600 applicants for four or five firefighter openings. There's very little turnover amongst firefighters, and when you've got anywhere from 30% to 50% of their final score being arrived at through a competitive physical fitness event or events, then you've got to appreciate that they are truly a medically select group, and they are an elite physical batch of people. And I think that should lend even more credibility to those kind of alarming statistics that we saw in the film.
Yes, for simple
just a comment. You know, it shows me in what we saw there that the firefighters are excited about their job.
Precisely.
I can just say
you always have a unique perspective.
I think I made this remark a couple of years ago, but my brief experience in the service, I had a week of carrier firefighting in Treasure Island, San Francisco, and that week's experience, in addition to losing my eyebrows and other singed hair and other experiences, I remember coughing up residue of that experience for several weeks thereafter. Mm-hmm. So my personal experience sort of corroborates the nature of the conditions and kinds of involvement when there's a fire aboard ship or any other place. Mr. Usher, go ahead.
Well, I'd just like to testify, and I've been president of Local 43 for 20 years and also spent 15 years as a trustee of the Portland Fire and Police Disability and Retirement Fund, of which we have presumption in its entirety as far as the heart and lung that is in this particular bill. And I think that you will find that firefighters do suffer more stress and strain in their firefighting than most other occupations are entitled to this. Back in 1948, when we went to the vote of the people to have our, which is now Chapter 5 of the City Charter of Portland, passed, it passed by a large majority, and the arguments then are the same as the arguments now, that firefighting is a occupation that has a lot of stress and strain and breathing of noxious gases, even with the event of the smoke mask that they now wear. And it is heart and lung are diseases that are more susceptible to firefighters than any other group of people.
I think we might ask your counsel if we can just get a copy of that City of Portland provision.
I think I'll gladly supply you with them. I did last 2 years ago, as you recall, and I'll be more than glad to send a copy for each of you down.
I'm not sure if you can, perhaps, Mr. Escher, provide us with some statistics as to the number of Portland firefighters and those who have qualified for that disability. This way, I might get some idea.
I think I can do that.
If you can, I think that might be helpful.
I think the chief's office just ran a survey of that here a short time ago.
I think we
there's quite a large number of firefighters off with heart and lung disabilities in the Portland area.
Representative Hanley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Escher and Mr. Whalen, did I understand you correctly, Mr. Escher, that you have the conclusive presumption already in the the Portland statute?
It's in the Portland statute. Or, charter, city, chapter 5 of the city charter of Portland,
my
which
quest-
is the Fire and Police Disability Retirement Fund.
My question relates to... and it's really directed to both of you. On 2700, how, in your opinions, would employers deal with this conclusive presumption? And I suppose that's directed to both of you in how you have and how, Mr. Whalen, you see that the entire state would deal with this presumption employer-wise.
If I could answer that, Tom Whalen. My suspicion would be that the employer would react in a responsible manner. They would try to get a handle on those controllable factors that predispose one to heart disease. I think they would be negotiating no smoking elements into the contract. They would provide their firefighters with control and diet, low-fat diets. They might be more likely to provide safety officers at fires. There would be annual re-examinations, I would suspect. And I think most importantly, they would probably do as they now do in L.A. County or L.A. City, whoever was the subject of that slideshow, I don't remember. But they now put their candidates through stress EKGs, and they know that from those that there's no underlying heart disease. As the film indicated, a resting EKG doesn't show those preconditions.
In the city of Portland, we, of course, before we take an applicant into the fire service, give him a very stringent physical examination, including a EKG under stress. We have a physical fitness program and a weight program continually in the fire department with a stress test given every year. And basically, we keep our people pretty fit. And even with that, we have a number go off on heart and lung disorders.
As I indicated earlier, there's a much less turnover amongst firefighters, employees, than the general workforce, and therefore they tend to hire in small increments, and that would be a front-end expense that I wouldn't think would be prohibitive.
Mr. Whalen, did you have a stress EKG?
No, I didn't.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Could you furnish us a copy of the fitness program the Portland
Wolves in our general orders.
Okay, fine. Another thing I'd like, Tom, is your position going to be one of opposition to the things you described? I think the papers have indicated that your organizations have not supported any of the things you've...
I don't know how my name got in that in the paper regarding that.
But I read the Salem paper like you do, and it's clear that they don't, that the firefighters don't support any of this. I don't know how you can say
I indicated a support of sitting down at the bargaining table and bargaining one of those elements into the contract. What was done here, we had through the Civil Service Commission, this rule imposed on us, and it's a it's questionable in several respects. It was for the first time they were actually imposing their will on what we did on our days off, which was, I didn't find that real comforting as a precedential matter. I sat there and listened to testimony that indicated that through these annual physical evaluations we get, they take our blood samples and they can develop a norm on carboxyhemoglobin content, in other words, how much smoke is in the blood. And when they suspect that somebody is smoking cigarettes on their days off, they can then throw him down and extract some blood from his arm and run a test and find out what his carboxyhemoglobin content is. And that not only offended me, but it offended the city attorney who was in the room at the time, and she indicated that they probably wouldn't be implementing a policy like that. But I thought that was something that was a working condition. Philosophically, that was something that should be addressed at the bargaining table and not something that should be imposed on us unilaterally. And we incidentally supported no smoking in the stations. The few smokers, and we're having fewer and fewer of them, are a distinct minority now, and they're a very unpopular minority. And we weren't at all opposed to firefighters not smoking. It was a way in which it was imposed on us.
I'll ask one last question.
Yes,
have you proposed this action in any of your salary negotiations at the bargaining table?
No.
You choose to come to the legislature. That's all.
Okay, I think just in case some members or the committee or audience didn't understand the previous exchange, that it was related to, I believe, an announcement from the city of Salem related to one of the risk factors, which was smoking cigarettes, as whether or not that was going to be permitted for firefighters who are employees of the city.
Yeah, the city of Salem, responsibly, I think, wished to eliminate that as a predisposer to heart disease, heart and lung disabilities. And I just questioned the way they went about it. Was all. I didn't disagree with their mission.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shiprock, and then Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, a few years back, with the rapid increase in PVC piping, different types of electrical insulations and such, there was it was found that these did create very noxious fumes during a fire. And there was some talk of changing some of the building codes and the use of these materials, building materials. Did that ever happen? Has there been any movement in that direction? Or,
you know, Representative Shiprock, I believe, reviewing the bills as they come across my desk, the volume that they come across your desk, I believe I saw that type of legislation being introduced this session.
Oh, really?
I can't swear to that, but I was recently reading something to that effect.
But the state building codes have not addressed the issue
yet? I'm not sure if they have at this point. I'm sure one day they will, if they haven't already. It's a clear danger to both the occupants and the firefighters.
I burned some copper one time, and unfortunately stuck my head to see how it was doing and got a whiff of that stuff. It literally takes your breath away.
Well, we have fire extend through those vent pipes, PVC, and we have to eat those to extinguish the fire in there. It's bad. It's bad bananas.
Okay, Representative Hanlon.
Tom, the vice chair asked you about, have you asked about bargaining on this conclusive presumption? Is that something that would be bargainable under the workers' comp law?
Well, under the State Collective Bargaining Act, I that's the first time I'd considered it when Representative Johnson posed a question. If that could be arguably fall within wages, hours, and working conditions, I suppose we could demand a bargain over it. I can just say that it hadn't occurred to me to bargain over workers' compensation laws, and I don't know of any instance where that has been proposed to be bargained over.
I doubt very much that you could.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments?
Thank you, gentlemen.
I'll see that Tom gets a copy of our fitness program and our pension act for each and every member.
I asked for it.
I gave you one 2 years ago.
You are tight.
You are tight.
I might add.
Public funds, I guess.
I might add that the city of Salem now has a mandatory physical fitness program. We're given an hour a day. We're provided with exercise, rowing machines. We've got a manual on what's expected of us, and every 9 months we're given a physical fitness test, which I am one of the administrators of that. And we test for oxygen uptake, the capacity of the lungs, the heart, and also body fat. It's something that's already in effect in Salem.
Okay. Thank you. We'll look forward to receiving that information. Let me ask you, before you leave, though, Mr. Whalen, did you have any additional comments on 2476? Or are there...
Ray Barnwell is going to carry that.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and hear the proponent on 2476, and then I'll call the individuals who have signed up on these two bills to testify. Mr. Barnwell, did you wish to add any comments on 2476?
Probably the majority of cases, then, when a firefighter has received a comp determination and is, you know, ready to accept his and to apply for disability retirement and to admit that he can no longer be a firefighter, he is indeed in that, gone through quite a heavy, substantial psychological change, and it's kind of a last resort situation for him. I guess what I'm looking for, I'm groping around to find out, and this is one of the concerns that we have in the in disability retirements overall, is whether people are feigning disability for retirement purposes. And the testimony that we've had earlier today is the tremendous competition for firefighter positions, the tremendous will that people must have to gain the position. And I guess what I'm trying to determine is whether, after going through that over a number of years, you think that people are trying to opt out for disability, to take the cheap road out.
I'm not saying that can't happen. That can happen everywhere. The way the firefighters live, we live like a family. We fight fire together. We sleep, you know, in the same dormitories. We eat together. We work 24-hour shifts on duty, and there is, we watch our brother, and if we think our brother's faking an injury, because it's just like, you know, someone in the family faking, you know, getting sick so they don't have to go to school or whatever, we keep an eye on him, and we also protect our benefits, because we know that if you cheat on your disability, that you're hurting you're hurting everyone concerned, and we do our best to police that. Like I say, you're not always successful, but we try like the devil to keep that from occurring. And we would hope that no firefighters would stoop that low, although, you know, there are exceptions, and I can't make excuses for those.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Barnwell. Particularly, we appreciate the circumstances, your long commute to come up to share your testimony with us.
Thank you.
And we have a couple individuals who signed up on both bills. I'm going to ask them to testify roughly in sequence here. Kurt Berger on 2700.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kurt Berger representing the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities, speaking to House Bill 2700. Mostly I wanted to inform the committee we have a couple of folks who would like to testify on the bill. We're not able to be here today because of schedules that were made before the hearing was announced, and we would certainly hope there would be another opportunity for them to come in and testify on the bill.
Can you tell us who those folks are or just what they're testifying?
Representatives of the City of Salem and the City of Eugene. It is the League of Oregon City's position and the Association of Oregon County's position to be opposed to the bill as it is drafted. That testimony will expand on that and talk in detail about the issues of the bill. We have no argument with compensing those injuries. We have no argument with the current law, which presumes the job-related disability. We certainly do oppose going to a conclusive presumption.
Okay. Mr. Breer, I don't know if I interpreted your comment earlier correctly or not, but you said you had no objection to the bill as drafted. Do you have any amendments contemplated, or has there been any discussion we should be aware of?
I would suggest that maybe there is, after we have heard the testimony of our representatives, that there may be an opportunity for us to sit down and see if there is something between what we have now and what the bill proposes that would fairly treat occupational injuries of firefighters. We're open to discuss it. We do not support the bill as it's drafted. We're certainly willing to discuss the issue of arriving at a fair and equitable determination of firefighter occupational injury.
Well, just as I think we advise anyone that comes before this committee, to the extent that you either have amendments to propose or you are able to reach some discussion or common agreement with the several parties involved, if you would be so kind as to sort of keep us involved for the results of your amendment process or discussions to us, we'd certainly like to be informed of that, obviously.
We would like to get our positions more formally on the record, and at that time, maybe members of the committee who would like to join in that discussion. But we wanted to hear what the proponents of the bill had to say, and we will, I'm sure, try and make some opportunity available to sit down and see if we can sort the problem out. We certainly cannot support the bill as it is drafted.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Berger? Okay, thank you. We will, I think it's reasonable to assume, be scheduling this for a subsequent hearing. And I can't give you the exact date, but we certainly will allow every opportunity for the witnesses who couldn't be here today to testify.
Appreciate that.
Okay, that's it as far as 2700. Moving on to 2476, Mr. McGoffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim McGoffin, Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. The board has reviewed the amendments on House Bill 2476, and based on some research by counsel, it's their position to oppose the amendment for a couple of reasons. One, in particular, it only applies to the police and fire segment and does not apply to all general service employees. And as far as the technical parts of the bill being ambiguous, questions were asked by Representative Hammond concerning the law. The law, the workman's compensation law, and its requirements for disability awards are different than those of PERS. The benefits are often requested from both of the agencies simultaneously, and a final determination under the law, under the workman's compensation law, may not come about until the case is appealed through the various levels all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court. Whether the board is conclusively bound by such a decision under the workman's comp law then would depend upon an interpretation of what is meant by the final determination under the law. Secondly, the amendment states that the final determination under the compensation law would be conclusive only if the determination satisfies the conditions specified in our act. The conditions specified in our act are different, as I mentioned, than those required by workman's comp. And under under the law, a mere aggravation of a pre-existing injury would be deemed to be compensable, whereas under the act, the PERS Act, the injury must be caused, the service-connected disability defined as bodily injury causing the disability directly and independently of all other causes and affected solely through accidental means. The Attorney General's Office has interpreted this definition injury as excluding mere aggravation, and that was approved in the court Savage versus Purse, 49 Oregon 483, back in 1980. Finally, the amendment requires that the board shall make its decision of disability on the basis of that final determination under the comp law and would not require a medical examination by our system. If the board is conclusively bound by the final determination under the comp law, then it has no actual decision to make, and it would be, it seems to us, far better for both the compensation system and the retirement system to possibly remove the service-connected disability allowances from PERS and increase, possibly increase the long-term disability under the workman's comp area, rather than put us into a situation of having to rely on medical examination and facts that refer to different requirements of the law in these instances. We do pay a benefit of 50% of salary under this granted service disability, so it is a substantial amount. As asked, I do not have any statistics for you as to how this might affect the fund. I doubt that it would seriously affect any employer liability in its totality, since their liabilities are merged in the state, certainly under the state employer rates, and any increase in that area would probably be very minimal. However, for the political subdivisions, this could be or could not be substantial based on the use the incident rate. That would conclude any statement we would have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I don't know if you'll have a chance to put your remarks in writing or...
We'd hope to.
That might be helpful. Yeah. And members might request, as you may have observed earlier, to the extent that there's any statistical information you might be able to provide to us, that would be helpful, I think. Representative Johnson.
Could you give us the citation on your ERS statute?
Yes.
That you read.
The citation of the case Savage versus Purse was 49 Oregon 483 in 1980. Our citation for the bill, of course, is 237.630, and 237.171 is the disability section.
That's what I want.
Yes, sir.
131. Thank you.
And we'll be very happy to follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Let me just. You referred to the advice of a position taken by your board. Was that a unanimous position?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you referred to a recommendation of counsel. Am I correct in understanding that
the Attorney General?
The Attorney General.
Our assigned Assistant Attorney General, Mr. William Holscher.
Okay. I think part of the objection related to the fact that the bill as written would create a category, if you will, that includes firefighters
mm-hmm.
and yes. police as opposed to other workers. If all employees were treated in the same manner, would that alleviate, or at least in part, the objection of the board?
Certainly that objection.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. McGough? Okay. If not, thank you very much for coming down. We appreciate it. That's it as far as the individuals who have signed up to testify on both these bills, 2700 and 2476. Before we leave the public hearing, though, I want to ask if there are other members who have any comments, anyone else wish to testify. Mr. Berger?
I must have missed that one in the shuffle of paper this morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kirk Berger, representing the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities. Maybe to touch on a little broader issue, and Mr. McGoffin touched on it somewhat. We have not introduced any legislation to accomplish this, but we have talked about it in the past, the issue of both the workers' comp and PERS duty disabilities, and that maybe it is appropriate to look at whether there should be two duty disabilities. Maybe that should be relegated to workers' comp as a sole determination, which would help resolve some of the concerns that I think proponents of this bill have in terms of having to go through two separate avenues to achieve a settlement of their claim. We have introduced another bill, House Bill 2831, which addresses a concern we do have about having multiple sources of disability income from workers' comp, PERS, Social Security, possibly some other benefit programs, and we have introduced a bill that would attempt to coordinate the those disability payments so that the injured worker receives fair and just compensation but does not receive compensation in excess of the wage they were earning at the time of the injury. Maybe all these issues get folded in together somehow or other, and we should attempt to sort all of that out. We, for some of the reasons that Mr. McGoffin raised, we do oppose the bill as it is drafted, partly because we're not sure what it really means yet. I don't know how we relate the language here of final determination between workers' comp and PERS. We seem to have an apples and oranges situation here in terms of what those two bodies do in determining awards. If they're, you know, we believe that PERS funds should be administered and awarded by the PERS board, not by workers' comp. If there is some way to cut down on the duplication of expense where the bodies could use some of the same information, make their own decisions with that information, but use one source of information, I suppose that's a possibility, something we could look at. We do believe PERS board should continue to make determinations of how the funds that are contributed by employers and employees under that system are spent.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions, Mr. Berger? We are, I think, going to conduct some research to the extent that and get some more information as to the variance that exists between our definitions of disability under the workers' comp system and PERS. I presume, as a philosophically speaking, it can be a strong argument can be made that whenever under our Oregon statutes we create or establish benefits for disability, that to the extent that the definition of disability is consistent under law, just to ease the cost of litigation, if you will, at each step, whether it be through a judicial doctrine of collateral estoppel or what have you, some purpose might be served by that. But I think that's going to await just the results of our research, just to learn to what extent the courts are interpreting these definitions differently. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any other public testimony on either 2476 or House Bill 2700? Okay, if not, based upon the testimony, the request for an opportunity to receive additional testimony, and the fact that I think that we are going to be receiving additional material from the several witnesses who have testified, we're going to continue or carry over to another work session consideration of both those bills. We have scheduled in our revised agenda for this portion of our hearing another bill that was carried over from Monday, and that's House Bill 2493, and that's relating to utility workers and the right to strike. This has been a subject of a prior hearing. I guess I'd ask counsel if there's any additional information that we receive to point out to members as part of the record, or if there are any amendments which were proposed or any action that was taken might be proposed for consideration on House Bill 2493.
Mr. Chairman, I have received no additional information or correspondence on this bill myself. No amendments to my knowledge have been proposed. And therefore, none have been adopted.
Okay. I did receive a request from a Mr. Lee Schwartz, who I believe had testified earlier, for an opportunity to testify briefly. Normally, we don't encourage testimony during our work session, but if Mr. Schwartz is present or would like to comment further, we'd be glad. We do have a couple other individuals who signed up, and I would, I guess, afford them the same brief courtesy of testifying, and that's a representative from the Canby Utility Board and also Mr. Berger. If those individuals would like to come forward together, maybe we can expedite that portion of the work session. And please be sure to identify yourselves for the record and your association or affiliation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is members of the committee. My name is Neil Kenoyer. I'm a new member to the Canby Utility Board. I was recently appointed. And this bill was brought to my attention because of its possible impact on our bargaining and negotiations and so forth. I had a long conversation with Representative Shiprock about this bill Monday night, and I must also mention that this is not an official view of the Canby Utility Board. I was not able to get a quorum together to get an official point of view. I came down to hear if there are further testimony, and forgive me if I repeat anything that was said previously because I didn't have a chance to hear other testimony. In my discussion with Representative Shiprock, I don't think our position came down strongly opposed to the idea of binding arbitration as much as the idea of the timing. This bill has been introduced now when at a period in the economic times, and Bob, this is one thing we hadn't discussed, I don't think, or at least to any real extent. Times are tough for employees, and I see it as kind of a fair weather friend to the right to strike situation, and now times are tough, so let's go with binding arbitration so it'll be easier for union officials not to have to negotiate tough contracts, maybe possibly come up with some concessions, and therefore go to binding arbitration. My proposal to the committee is possibly if binding arbitration is a good idea, it was a good idea 4 years ago when times were better, and possibly if the unions are interested in looking at that again, it'll be a good idea in 2 years during the next session of the legislature. I don't question the bill or content of the bill. I think points could be argued either way. I think it could go both ways. I think binding arbitration for a lot of municipalities and small boards in small areas could be good for those boards and those members of quote-unquote the employer because of the fact they won't have to mess with the striking problem, but it would also be a disadvantage to the extent that in the job that I'm in, I'm covered by a collective bargaining agreement, and I think that the right to strike possibly, if that were lost, would be a detriment to those employees in the long run. So I don't want to strongly argue the point. Maybe I don't have enough information, but I feel that the timing is suspect, and possibly it could be put off till the next session.
Thank you. Let me ask, what's your personal knowledge of how the collective bargaining process has worked within your jurisdiction in the last few years or contract discussions?
At the utility board?
Yes.
The relationship between the Canby Utility Board, although I am a new member, but from what I've seen has been basically amiable. We have two contracts with the IBEW for our electrical workers, and then the water and office workers have a contract. Have not been. Let me refer to Jim Branch as a member of our staff just for a moment. Would you say, Jim, that they've been adverse types of labor relations with unions? Or?
Well, I think that by nature they have to be a bit adverse because of decisions. The negotiation process has certainly been amicable. Things have been.
That would have been my answer. We, Cascade Employers, handles our actual negotiating. We look at the agreement and approve it in that sense. But to address it any further, I don't have that much experience with our particular group, our utility board.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Berger?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kirk Berger, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities. Mostly wanted to be here just to be available for questions. We had testified earlier in our opposition to the bill. Has had some other municipal utilities, and just wanted to make myself available if there were any further questions.
Okay, I believe we did at the earlier hearing receive quite a bit of testimony and some statistical data that was helpful to us. Are there any questions for Mr. Berger, members of the committee? Okay, I want to give anyone else, since we have permitted some public testimony in opposition, if there's anyone who wishes to respond or to speak to 2493. I want to let any individual or individuals have that chance to do so now. Is there anyone who wishes to speak? If not, Representative Shiprock?
Yeah, I think I'd move House Bill 2493 to the floor with a pass recommendation.
Yes, Representative Johnson. Let me place the motion first. Representative Shiprock moves House Bill 2493 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, electrical workers and the utility workers especially have probably the most admirable record of dealing with management on the issue of union contracts, and I think they march arm in arm to try to solve the problems they have between them. I think this creates a precedent that will be very, very dangerous and bad for both them and the public, in that what we are seeing is we're trying to bypass an existing system that has always worked and will work. And I just think that what we've done is another case where the group is coming to the legislature to try to deal directly with a problem rather than dealing with it across the bargaining table and using the existing system. And I think it's a bad precedent. We're going to have every group in the public employee sector out here saying we don't want a strike, we want to have binding arbitration. So they're going to be here asking for it. I oppose the bill. I think it's a bad precedent, despite my respect for the electrical workers, unions, and management.
Okay. Are there any additional comments? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Ford?
No.
Gold?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Leek?
Aye.
Shiprock?
Aye.
Brigiati?
No.
DeBoer?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. 2493 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Shiprock will allow you the honors.
Thank you.
We're going to take a five-minute recess and come back. Again, we've got a 10:30 session, so the balance of our agenda we're going to have to deal with expeditiously. Representative Johnson served notice of a possible minority report.
Getting you guys, was it last night you said? I think it was a lobbyist who succeeded in getting you people in. Diane had tried, and
made all kinds of offers, we couldn't refuse.
And so the lobbyist succeeded.
Okay. House Labor Committee will come to order, please. This is a resumption of our morning hearing. We've already, for the record, we've had action on the earlier work session on 2425. 2512. We've also had our earlier hearing and work session on 2493, 2476, and 2700. The two bills remaining are 2377 and 2019. I'm going to go ahead and take 2377 first, as the agenda indicates. However, before we do that, 2377 was tabled by rule, and the chair would move that 2377 be removed from the table for consideration, testimony, and work session. Is there any objection to the chair's motion to remove 2377 from the table? There are, I believe, representatives of the Insurance Commissioner's Office who requested an opportunity to testify or present some additional information before us. I'd like to ask those individuals to come forward first. Mr. McGavick, Mr. Lamb, others that have any additional information for us, we'd be pleased to receive that at this time.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Dick McGavick, head of Rates and Forms, Insurance Division. The insurance commissioner is out of state at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners executive meeting. I'll be back till Tuesday. And
where's that?
National Association of Insurance Commissioners.
Where are they meeting?
Maryland.
Maryland, okay. I think perhaps Mr. Green is also attending a similar meeting. Go ahead. Sorry for the interruption.
The Insurance Division is responding to the request of the committee and actually is not providing any additional testimony, but only responding to the inquiries to the amendments of House Bill 2377, I believe, that were presented at the March 8th hearing on the bill. And our analysis of the amendments from a technical point of view would be that the additions, and I have only the engrossed version before me, that the additions on line 13 and ours, and then the delineation of subsection B to section 1 would be redundant, in as much that under section 2, excuse me, I'm comparing the March 8th amendment with what I, with the amendment of March 30th, which I haven't had the opportunity to see.
Okay, while you're taking just a moment to review that, I'll share with members the fact we have distributed, I think, and placed a new person's bill file, a copy, some hand-engrossed amendments that were prepared by counsel at my request, and it bears the date and the notation, hand-engrossed with Rep. Springer's amendments 33083. And Mr. McGavick, I think, is reviewing that. The purpose, basically, let me go through those amendments. In addition to the, I think, the concept stated earlier in the bill, we tried to deal with a couple questions that were raised by witnesses earlier. One had to deal with the testimony of representatives of the agriculture industry. We have a very real concern about whether or not their employees would be covered by this provision. And we worked out one attempt at language which would exclude them. Their response was that they didn't feel the our effort was necessarily successful. So we have, in the hand-engrossed version, we've made an additional change to make it more clear that we have, and it would be the intent of the amendments to exclude agriculture employees completely. And we also, addressing the concern of Safe Corporation's manager, Mr. Faulkner, we have, I believe, established clearly that we're not talking just about Safe Corporation, we're talking about all private carriers. And I think the intent also, of course, would be for self-insured, treat everyone the same in that manner. A further amendment that's been placed at the bottom relates to